robbery and whatever, sitting down before quarter past. That's a very good time for all of us here, notwithstanding the urgent meetings beforehand. I would also then like to just welcome everyone here first, including those who are coming to present. But before we do that, we do need the apologies from Mr. Herman, the committee secretary.
I receive no formal apologies from any member.
Thank you very much. Right. Members, we, due to challenges we experienced yesterday with time constraints, we found that it was impossible for us to get through the AR, and so, as you know, we requested in committee for the secretary to rearrange the program for today, so that we're only dealing with two people, of the presenters, the Funding Practice Alliance and the Aristocrat regarding gambling, and we're going to have to factor in another day. We had one day's extra hearing and we're going to be needing another day's full extra hearing as well in this regard. On that note, I would like to welcome, I see the Funding Alliance is first, the Funding Practice Alliance, Ms. Joanne Harding, Ms. Gabby Ritchie, and Ms. Nomvula Dlamini, and we've handed out some of the documents here. If we can restrict, we find that it's useful to get a short input and then to have the engagement so that we're able to direct some of the questioning that we have. So looking at what we've got here, if we can try and restrict our input to the committee, the presentation, to 10 minutes if possible, not reading word for word, but highlighting the issues that you would like to share with us.
Two of us will be presenting, Chairperson.
I didn't hear the program. I'm a tuner on to four today.
Introduce yourself, because I'm not sure in what capacity you are sitting here.
I'm a younger vet from the Free Trade Bloemfontein. I'm presenting Amatuna 40. Is Amatuna going on for today?
Right. The committee.
Through you, Chairperson.
Yeah.
On behalf of the Funding Practice Alliance, I would like to thank the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry for affording us this opportunity to bring our voice and to make the presentation. We are a team of three from four organizations that are part of the Funding Practice Alliance. The main presentation will be done by Joanne Harding. I'm really just here to sketch a little bit of background to the Funding Practice Alliance. Let me just start by saying, who is the Funding Practice Alliance? This alliance comprises of four organizations: the Community Development Resource Association, which is my organization, Social Change Assistance Trust, of which Joanne is a former director, and Inyathelo, the South African Institute for Advancement, and Gabby Richards is from Inyathelo. Unfortunately, there is no representative from the fourth organization, which is the Rural Education Access Program. If I may, I would just like to sketch briefly the purpose of the Funding Practice Alliance. These four organizations have a vast collective experience in working with non-profit organizations. The Funding Practice Alliance was specifically set up to conduct research into various critical aspects and practices of the non-profit sector. Amongst the work that our organizations do, looking into funding practices, giving and grant-making practices, looking into the relationships between recipients of grants and grant-makers is part of the work of these four organizations. So together, as the four organizations, for many years and vast experience in interacting with non-profit organizations, collectively, we work with large numbers on an annual basis of non-profit organizations and civil society organizations, including from small community-based organizations to large international agencies. Among these, we also include grant-making organizations. It should be noted that these four organizations that form the alliance work across many different sectors, in fact, across all the sectors of the non-profit sector, as well as working with organizations in rural settings as well as urban settings. So, through our work, all four of us, we became very aware over the last couple of years of the frustrations regarding the funding from the National Lottery Distribution Trust Fund. But what did we ought to do as organizations? Instead of embarking on a whole journey of moaning and groaning and adding to the frustrations, this alliance opted for a much more strategic response to what we were hearing from the different organizations. And we decided to conduct research into the National Lotteries Board as well as the National Development Agency, because we needed to get a much more insightful view of how these agencies are disbursing funds to non-profit organizations. In other words, we challenged ourselves to rather do research so that we can have the empirical evidence on which we could then engage the National Lotteries Board together with the National Development Agency. And we are using the empirical evidence from the research to engage the National Lotteries Board, and are very much interested through such engagement to rather opt for a solution-driven conversation. This research that was conducted by the Alliance in 2010 highlighted the contribution the National Lotteries Board is making towards supporting non-profit organizations that work in social development. And this is admirable, and it needs to be commended. This contribution, or the funding support that the National Lotteries Board is making, is particularly appreciated in a time when many non-profit organizations are struggling with funding, given that over the last couple of years, foreign donor funding has decreased. So, increasingly, the funding from the National Lotteries Board to non-profit organizations is becoming very important, and it is playing a big role in sustaining the sector. However, as it is with the nature of research, the research also highlighted the problem areas, including the shortcomings of the legislation that underpins the mandate of the National Lotteries Board. And as is with research, we know that many of us, many of you, many people out there could probably knock a lot of holes into the research. However, some of the findings are genuinely valid, as you will see in the reports that we have brought along. So it is on the basis of the problem areas, as well as the shortcomings of the legislation that underpins the mandate of the National Lotteries Board, that we are choosing to engage that we are choosing would like to add our voice as the Funding Practice Alliance to the call for a review of the legislation. I'm now going to hand over to Joanne, who is going to do the main presentation, and part of the presentation will highlight some of the problem areas that I have just mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you very much, through the chair. The focus of my presentation is on our findings in the research. You should all have a copy of the research, a summary of the findings, and there's also the full research, which includes the outcomes of our investigation into the lotteries and the National Development Agency. Our focus, obviously, today is on the National Lotteries Board and the National Lotteries Distribution Fund. One of our key findings is that in the Act there is no statement of intent and there is no long-term purpose for the fund. This means that funding that is given in quite randomly, and from year to year the purpose of the fund seems to change. So our key recommendation in this regard is that the Act needs to have a statement of intent, and it needs to indicate the contribution that the funds are going to make to the kind of society we want to live in. But this statement of intent should also give consideration for those organizations which make longer-term contributions to change in our society. We have, you know, short-term safety net organizations, which are traditionally welfare organizations, and then you have the social change organizations who will make a contribution to longer-term and more sustainable change. Our second finding is that there's a lack of accountability and confusing lines of accountability in the Act. And this is demonstrated by the fact that the distribution agencies, which according to the Act are appointed by the Minister, are not accountable to the National Lotteries Board. They're in fact accountable to the Minister. But opportunities for holding these distribution agencies accountable seems to be limited. It also means that the public cannot go to the National Lotteries Board and request that they hold these distribution agencies accountable. Now, issues of accountability are highlighted when the performance of the distribution agencies is at under 50%. They have distributed under 50% of their funds available consistently over the last 4 to 5 years. And we know that in the recent judgment of Ahmed Kachalia in the Supreme Court of Appeals, that he proclaimed that 6 billion rand was unspent, and that we know that and that was in 2009, and on an ongoing basis money is unspent. We also know that many organizations wait for over a year to get a response to their funding. We know of organizations that have applied in 1 year and get money 2 years later. Now, if you put in a budget in 2007 and you get your money in 2010 and you're expected to spend according to a 2007 budget, you're going to have limitations in your budget. Also, in the current environment that we're in, plans change. The plan that you submitted in 2007 is not going to be relevant necessarily in 2010. So we are calling for clear lines of accountability between the distribution agencies and the National Lottery Board. Funding criteria and practice is also a huge concern for us. Although there are clear guidelines advertised every year and criteria, we find that the guidelines are used either very rigidly or they change from response to different organizations. And they're also applied without any concern for the beneficiaries that are receiving the funding. And I'll demonstrate this by organizations reporting to us that they submit the application. They have every page of the application signed when it is received by the distribution agencies or by the National Lotteries Board. And then they are told that documents are lost or that pages are missing and the application is rejected. Now, this shows little concern for the beneficiaries of the funds. Instead of saying, please resubmit your audit, we can't find the pages that are missing, or could you send us that one page that is not in the documentation. They will reject the application, send a letter saying that the application is rejected on the basis of a page being missing. And Ahmed Kachalia also found in his judgment that this didn't show much care or concern for the beneficiaries and that they applied their guidelines too rigidly. Obviously, because of limited capacity, the National Lotteries Board say they have to apply the guidelines rigidly. They don't have the time to deal with all these problems. We find that highly unacceptable. They need to have the capacity to ensure that the distribution takes place. And that they must apply the guidelines with care and concern for the beneficiaries, remembering that most of the money that goes to the distribution agencies is for the charity sector, I think it's 48%, and that is mostly going to the poorest of the poor. The other issue that we have is that small community-based organizations are currently limited in their ability to apply for funding from the lotteries. They have to use technology, they have to have a computer, they have to do it online. You have to fill in the form online while the form is active. You cannot copy the form, download it, fill it in, and then print it out and send it. You have to fill it in online, print it and send it. You cannot save the document. Now, for a small community-based organization to have to do that is almost impossible. We also find that these community-based organizations, which certainly should be benefiting from the lottery fund, do not get the support and assistance that they need from the National Lottery Fund or from the distribution agencies. So we recommend that a small grant-making mechanism be set up, or that the National Lotteries Board should work with other grant-making organizations. There also are serious challenges with the capacity of the National Lotteries Board. This capacity is not just in numbers of people, it's also in their understanding of the sector, their understanding of the cycles, the planning cycles, the financial management cycles, and they also have limited capacity to handle the volumes of applications. I think that applications are sitting at about nearly 12,000 this year. In previous years, we've seen anything up to 7,000, 8,000 applications. And the distribution agencies, as far as we know, sit only 2 days a month. Now, getting through all of those applications in 1 year, you can see that there is going to be a shortfall. So there needs to be a more permanent structure in place to assess those applications. We know that there's administrative staff that go through this and check that all the documentation is in place and that the organizations meet the criteria, but it's the distribution agencies that actually assess the applications. So we say that the staff, they should be permanent staff, they should have the relevant skills and training to understand the community services organization sector. We also think that the National Lotteries Distribution Trust Fund, or the NLB, needs to have a 5-year strategy, because short-term funding means that you have lots of problems. To explain this, you have to apply for your funding from the National Lotteries Distribution Trust Fund every year. Now, if we had 5-year strategies and multi-year grant making, you would have fewer applications. If you gave a 3-year grant to an organization, it would mean they wouldn't have to apply every year. You wouldn't have to deal with the application every year. It would reduce the burden on the fund. And that would mean you probably wouldn't need more staff. You would just be dealing with fewer applications. We also believe that the lotteries fund needs greater legal capacity, because organizations are waiting sometimes a year to get the funds that have been promised to them. And this seems to be related to signing off of contracts and following up on legal procedures. Secondly, the miscellaneous funds. We feel that there's limited public accountability for the use of the miscellaneous funds. We find it unacceptable that funds have gone to CASAR, to state agencies like the National Youth Development Fund, and Chapter 9 institutions like the Commission for Gender Equality. These are organizations and agencies that should be well-funded and funded from the fiscus and not from the lotteries fund. We believe that the funding from the lotteries fund should be ring-fenced for community service organizations, and we also believe the minister should be held accountable for funds allocated to other agencies. My last point, that we believe that there should be ongoing learning and feedback. There are limited mechanisms for the civil society to give feedback to this fund. Many organizations try to get through. You get through to the communications person who just tells you it's the NGOs that are the problem. But regular feedback would contribute to improved performance and ongoing learning. So our recommendation in this regard is that an ongoing feedback mechanism should be developed. And that's my last one.
Thank you very much. I just want to clarify before I ask for members, two or three of them, for the questions. Did you say that government should fund COSATU?
No, they did.
Because you did, no, you were saying that you would rather they did or something, which... not the funds, not the NLB. You know, so I just wanted to make sure I understood correctly.
No, I'm not saying that they should fund COSATU. I'm just saying that the National Youth Agency, sorry, maybe my words
yes,
ran into each other.
Yeah,
the National Youth Agency and...
Yes, I'm sure they'd be happy to hear that.
no, we're not saying that they should fund COSATU. We're just saying that...
That's fine. We've heard the explanation. Now, I'm going to have to be very short on the questions, please, at this point.
Chair, sorry, this is not a question.
Chair,
it's a point of clarity. I'm trying to understand which document she was reading from.
I'm reading from our oral submission.
No, I'm going to ask those who present to respect the chair.
Sorry.
Really am, because right now I'm on the floor with the committee, please. So I'm going to ask you to switch your mics off. Because really I think that we do need to check with our colleagues when we before putting that sort of question out. Right. Short questions, I am only taking three hands, please.
I'm afraid, Chairman, point of clarity remains. I'm not sure which document we...
Well, I'm sorry. If you check with your colleagues, they will show you, and it is here. Can we have your hands, those two or three, please? Honourable Mabasa, Mackenzie, Smala.
Thanks, colleague chair, and thanks for the input that we have received from the Funding Practice Alliance. My question is, does the Funding Practice Alliance ever have meetings with the distribution board or with the National Lotteries Board? And when I say the Funding Practice Alliance, I also mean with other organizations that are acting like yourselves. Is there such an opportunity where some of the weaknesses can be discussed and where you can see if you can find each other? That's the one question. But the last question is, how factually sure are you of the objections that you are raising, you know, which lead you to making recommendations? Because when we engage National Lotteries Board, we wouldn't be happy to find that what you are submitting is rumors, is not factual. So this is the point that I'm making. So that if you know that it's not quite factual, you must make us aware so that we don't move on a wrong premise. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mabasa. Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank Mr. Nomvula Dlamini for that introduction. I think the most important thing, and it helps us a lot, as members of this commission, is that you wanted to move the debate from a large pool of anecdotal impressions to sound empirical research. and I want to thank you for that. Can I also say that I am shocked at what has been told to us thus far. I mean, we have a society which is caring for the poor, and we also want to empower volunteerism and people who work hard, NGOs, and those sorts of people. And in other countries in the world, the lotto makes a big contribution. Here, we could make a big contribution, but it seems as though the whole system is running very poorly. But thank you for that, and I think we've all got the message that there's a serious problem at the National Lotteries Board and its distribution mechanisms. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable McIntosh. Honourable Smaller.
Thank you. Morning, Chair. Yes, we did manage to get most of these findings out with the committee that did the oversight of the National Lotteries Board. But let me try to focus on what the Funding Practice Alliance does or do, or how they do it. I would very much like to understand the closer relationship with the small, medium enterprises in the let's say, the more rural areas, if I can say it in that way, in one way or another. How do they actually approach you, or how do you approach them, and how do you assist them into some sort of a application towards any sort of funding, so that I can understand if there's some sort of a personal relationship between the two parties. Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Sadebe. That is the last one.
So thank you, Chairperson. I'll also concur with my colleagues in welcoming the report, even the input from the Alliance. But what is critical, I'm referring to their recommendations, what must happen in 2.1.2. When they speak about the issues of the DA, that it must be a permanent feature. What do they mean? Because when we deal with the law, there's one body of opinion. We say that the DAs must be removed. And then you seemingly, on the other side, you are confirming that they must be there, but they must be restructured. What is it you want to, because we want a clearer, want a more clarity around that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Sadebe. Yes. I think that certainly the National Lotteries Board has been part of our processes since 2009, and this particular committee itself, although we were in the process of dealing with the appointment of a board at that time, we did in the report raise the issue of a review of the DAs as well as the bill itself. So thank you very much for the input, and if you can respond very briefly to the questions that have been raised. Thank you.
The first question was whether we have opportunities to meet with the National Lotteries Board. We've met with members of the board. We met with members of the executive staff, Professor Vivek Ram and the chief operations officer. We had interviews with some of the staff at the National Lotteries Board, and we had interviews with some of the distribution agency members. So I hope that clarifies that we have made quite serious attempts to get information. And then also we have attended the public hearings which have been taking place with the National Lotteries Distribution Fund and with the National Lotteries Board. And there we made presentations on the basis of our research. So we have made attempts. But our key concern is that the Act is reviewed so that the operations follow the review of the Act. We have extensively,
John, through you, Chairperson, if I may just add, whilst the roadshows that were held by the National Lotteries Board were really appreciated by the non-profit sector. I think what is missing in the South African context is that there isn't an institutionalized platform where the non-profit sector, civil society organizations can engage through, you know, continuously, this ongoing dialogue between our organizations and the lotteries board, that is missing within our context. So to have once-off engagement through roadshows, yes, it's a first step, it is valued, but we need to start to think differently.
I think it's Mr. Zulini, isn't it, to just make sure. Yes. Is that the third response as well, perhaps?
The second question was about the research being empirical and to what extent our evidence is correct. We, you know, according to the judgment that was in the Supreme Court of Appeals, I've taken some of our facts from that judgment, and those facts would have to be correct. So the $6 billion underspent is in the judgment. The underperformance by over 50% is in the judgment, and we've given our copies of the judgment. So we have that as correct evidence. It wouldn't have gone to the Supreme Court without being correct. We know that it's been a running underspend. We don't know what has happened to the R6 billion that was underspent, and that's an official position in 2009. We can't believe that they would have caught up if they're not catching up on a year-by-year basis on spending what they have raised in that year. So, yes, we've tried to present all the evidence that we have that is factual and not just make-up information. And then some of the feedback on the guidelines and people's experience of the guidelines, I've been asking organizations to send the rejection letters that they've received from the lotteries. And there are huge contradictions in the rejection letters. Some are told that the lotteries doesn't have enough money to fund them, which is unbelievable. Others are told that because they've got some reserves, they're not needy enough. Now, do you have to be about to close down to get funding from the lotteries, or should you be showing good governance and be a sustainable organization? So there's big contradictions in the rejection letters, and those are factual evidence-based responses. I was asked about the relationship between our organizations and the rural communities and rural community-based organizations. The organization that I was running for the last 6 years works purely in rural community-based with rural community-based organizations. It's the Social Change Assistance Trust. But most of our organizations have some exposure or some experience of working with rural community-based organizations. We have tried on a number of occasions, as SCAT, as the director of SCAT, I tried to submit applications to bring together all of the community-based organizations that we were working with, and those applications were rejected because purely on the basis that we were an intermediary grant maker and that we couldn't apply as an intermediary grant maker. So that limited our ability to assist. Then we tried assisting organizations to fill in application forms, but because it's online and they're in rural communities, it's very hard to get to every organization and every community and sit down and help people fill in application forms. So that is my personal experience of working with rural community-based organizations, that the current system doesn't really accommodate them. Is that
to draw this to a close, the last point has to be made quite succinctly.
Okay. There are contradictions between what's being said about the distribution agencies and, you know, on one hand, they're not working. It's not effective. It's not effective. It's not efficient. So maybe it should be completely restructured. Or maybe they're not effective and efficient because they've got no one holding them accountable. So, yeah. Which is the correct answer? I'm not 100% sure. If they were held accountable to the National Lotteries Board, and the National Lotteries Board is accountable to the Minister, maybe they would be more effective. Or maybe there should be a complete restructuring, and we set up a grant-making agency. And it's full-time, permanent, and it's accountable to the Minister or the Board, but there has to be clear accountability, and there isn't at the moment.
Thank you very much, then. Is that Ms. Harding? Yes, sir. Thank you very much. But really thank you to the team. You came as a team. Thank you very much, Ms. Nombula Dlamini, Ms. Joanne Harding, and Ms. Gabby Ritchie for the input there. And I hope you will stay behind to hear a bit more. We're nowhere near completing these public hearings, and you should be aware of that. We are going to have to continue for some time. Thank you. I hope that we've got Aristocrat ready, please. Thank you to come to the fore. Aristocrat. Where is Aristocrat? Aristocrat. Okay. Yeah. We need, yeah, if we can just do that. Even if you move down, there's 3 seats down there, just move down, please. And then how many of you are there? It's just yourself. All right. So if we can just quickly do that and then allow someone else. Are you on a laptop?
No, but the system is not operational, so everyone can copy that.
Okay, I'm informed by the provincial, by the... I'm informed by the committee secretary that the system is not operational.
We will put it up before.
The new provincial secretary. Thank you, Ms. Honourable Harris.
I have a question and a comment. My question is, if we have further questions, which we definitely do, to the Funding Practice Alliance, should we submit them to them directly, or are we doing it to the committee?
A point at the end of the game,
okay,
in this regard, because I think we did do that last time, but thank you for raising it at this point.
My comment, Chair, because I didn't get a chance to ask a question, is that I'm alarmed to see from the programs I've seen that the National Lotteries Board and the National Lotteries Distribution Trust Fund aren't coming before us. I think on the strength of what we've heard today, we need to summon them to answer some of the questions.
No, they say they aren't coming. And I suppose it's one of the benefits of clocking in early, as I know you normally are. You get there just ahead of me on the racetrack. So, today, you know, I was just that little bit ahead, and we already explained that these have been postponed. One person did not get the message from his liaison, and his liaison is not connected with Parliament. It is the Parliament that his organization approached in this regard, to liaise with Parliament. But we did inform everyone on Tuesday, yesterday, when it became apparent that we would not receive any further time to complete the BRRR process, and that we would have to close off today. So I think that should be quite clear, and that was taken in committee, that decision, that we would have to readjust the program. They have been informed, they will be coming. I'm not going to repeat what I said yesterday. You see, I have already agreed to that we cannot, it's going to be a lengthy process. We need to discuss this when we have time. So I think that all of us members, and I will just ask all members, can we approach the committee secretary if we may have just missed some exigency, because especially when we're going towards the last phase of any process, it's wise to keep in touch. May we shift from the Funding Practice Alliance? We're not at the end of NLBs and those inputs by any stretch. And the Manufacturer Perspective on Gambling Review Commission report, we have the overhead submission in front of us. And just indicating to you that we are going to ask you to highlight this in 10 minutes so that we can engage you for a further 10 minutes, please. So welcome, Mr. Mumbot. Is that right? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. Honorable members of the Trade and Industry Committee, thank you very much for having me here. My name is Pramod, and I work for a company called Aristocrat. We are an electronic slot machine manufacturer and developer, and we also supply monitoring and control systems to the licensed casino industry. Now, the objective of my presentation was just to briefly describe who we are and what our position in the industry is, to applaud certain positive developments in national gambling legislation, to give a brief opinion on the Gambling Review Commission report, and to highlight parts of the report that affect manufacturers, what the impact of the Commission's findings are, and what recommendations we can put forward as a manufacturer. I'm going to skip ahead the first couple of slides, and I'm going to go straight through this slide here, which is National Gambling Legislation Applause. And I just want to say that in the National Gambling Act of 2004, two positive developments came about that helped our operations very much. One was the introduction of national licenses for manufacturing key employees. Prior to 2004, you'd have to apply in each province for a company and key employee license with all nine provincial gambling boards. This development has had the effect of saving us time and money in getting the necessary licensing to continue our operations. Also, the choice of licensed testing agents was made possible in the 2004 Act. Prior to 2004, the SABS was the only testing and certification and calibration agency, and this had the rather unwelcome effect of resulting in bottlenecks and severe delays in product entering the marketplace. Now, independent testing agents have provided choice to manufacturers and to other licensees with regards to getting products into the marketplace. In terms of the Gambling Review Commission report, it gave a very informative overview of the current state of the gambling industry, and the report presented a lot of very factual views from both members of the public, non-governmental organizations, and also licensed operations operating within the industry. If there's one constructive criticism that I could make on the report, it's that while rightly so, it's focused a lot on gambling and the impact of gambling activities on the public, it very briefly mentions some of the challenges faced by licensed businesses within the gambling industry and some of the onerous regulations that companies have to comply with in order to run their day-to-day operations. In terms of the report, the first topic is regarding approval of gambling devices and equipment, and what the Gambling Review Commission recommended, or observed rather, was that the NRCS certification is, in their eyes, sufficient for compliance of gambling equipment to national legislation. However, despite this, provinces still require further approval processes to be complied with. Another recommendation was made by them was the possible introduction of a national gambling equipment approval to be introduced, and this is to help to alleviate some of the administrative burden that many manufacturers and operators have to go through to get product approved for release into the marketplace. Now, from a manufacturer's point of view, we do agree with these observations and recommendations, and what we do propose is the current three-step process of approvals of gambling devices and equipment be reduced to two steps. And what I've presented is possible models that could be followed in terms of how gambling equipment can enter the marketplace. The first slide you see is the current three-step process that has to be followed by manufacturers and operators. And pretty much product gets tested by a test lab. It goes off to the NRCS for certification, and then it gets sent off, the certification gets sent off to nine different provincial gambling boards for approval for entry into their specific provinces. The one model I'd like to propose to look at is perhaps reducing that to two steps, and instead going from a test laboratory, we have a test report that goes straight to any of the provincial gambling boards, and it could go for a national gambling equipment approval, which would result in one approval letter for the same piece of equipment that was tested to national SABS gaming standards. That would help the administrative processes quite a lot for a lot of businesses operating in the industry to get product into the marketplace. Another model that the Gambling Review Commission proposed was that you have your, this model number two, by the way, you have your testing agent that tests the product, and the product test report goes off to the NRCS for certification, And that's pretty much then, that's it. Once it's certified by the NRCS, then it's deemed to be compliant to national standards and legislation. A third model that I've put together is taking model number two and then expanding it even further is you have a test report from a test agent and it then gets expanded and sent off into different independent certification bodies. And this is actually the preferred model for the industry due to certain issues and operational problems that have been encountered by the industry with the NRCS in the last 12 months. The opening up of the certification side of testing and certification would enable the industry to have choices in terms of certification bodies it could go to get products certified for the gambling industry. With regards to recommendations for gambling equipment, Clause 25.2 of the National Gambling Act to be amended to allow for multiple certification agencies, not just the NRCS. And then also if model number one, wherein a national gambling equipment approval is introduced, then this can be introduced and could run in parallel with provincial gambling approval requirements. And this is to enable like those provinces that don't allow certain pieces of gambling equipment, at least then the operators and manufacturers have an avenue of applying for a provincial gambling approval. The second observation on the report was regards to the FIC Act, and essentially the GRC observed that consideration should be given to amending the National Gambling Act to allow for an exemption to FICA compliance by holders of a manufacturer, supplier, or maintenance provider license. This was based on research carried out by the FIC, by the NGB, and my company that yielded that FIC was not designed for companies like Aristocrat, which are gambling equipment manufacturers and suppliers, and the FIC saying the likelihood of business encountering suspicious transactions is highly unlikely in our type of business. The recommendation that I would put forward is that Section 37.2B be amended to reflect exemption from compliance to FICA by a nationally licensed manufacturer. The second last observation or item in the regards to the GRC report was regarding improving uniformity and accountability in the regulatory framework. The GRC observed that although South Africa is a well-regarded regulated gambling jurisdiction, there does appear to be an overlap and a degree of inefficiency in the regulatory framework, and that the DTR together with the SABS should develop national norms and standards that should be discussed and agreed with provincial regulators. As a slot machine manufacturer, as a monitoring control systems provider, we have to apply to all nine provincial gambling boards right now for approval of gambling equipment as well as for transportation of equipment across the provinces. Each province has different turnaround times, procedures for application, as well as different competencies amongst their staff, and the impact is generally lengthy and onerous procedures to follow to bring new products to market and also to address the needs of our customers, which greatly affect the business viability of a lot of manufacturers. And the recommendation is recommended that where there are similar or the same requirements between different provincial legislation and so, that those requirements be lifted up and put into either national legislation or national norms and standards. And in the case of, say, applications for gambling equipment approval and transport approvals, a single norm and standard for these elements combined with having to lodge an application with just one gambling regulator as opposed to multiple ones would definitely be a quantum leap forward in business regulation and enabling all the businesses in the gambling industry to operate. A final observation on the Gambling Review Commission report as regards to BEE, and the GRC observed that while there is an overarching target of level 2 compliance by 2015, the method of implementation amongst the different provinces is different, and also this is currently not harmonized amongst the industry to give a focused view to a lot of licensees in terms of how to get to level 2 or if not level 2, what is the next best level. Although it appears that there are discussions in place right now, it is recommended that a consistent approach be taken and that all sectors in the industry be engaged to try and find the best level that will be pertinent to their size and nature of their enterprises. In closing of BEE, I'd like to say that an enterprise's best ever BEE level would be dependent on the size and nature of the organization. And instead of requiring a specific BEE level as proof of compliance, the enterprise should be alert to grow their programs to the best of their ability. And just with King III, the Code of Corporate Governance, where Judge Mervyn King took an apply and explain approach, perhaps that should also be taken with regards to BEE, especially among small businesses operating as manufacturers, where an apply or explain approach is taken, wherein what you can comply with, but what you can't, be able to explain why you can't, and there should be justifiable reasons why you cannot attain the specific levels. And that concludes my presentation, and I hope I was within the 10 minutes limit. Thank you.
Thank you very much in 8 minutes. Can we please have a show of hands from the, if I may request that you put your mic off, please. Thank you. Right. From the committee, if you wish to make any comments, raise any questions, please.
Okay. Chairperson, the presenter referred to some concerns that they have with the NRCS, and I'm just trying to understand what those actual concerns are. If you can just go a little bit broader with that, so it will help with us with our overview of what we're trying to do this up. Thank you.
Very important point. Thank you. Honourable Hadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was going to ask that very same question myself. If you can expand, what's the problem I'm having with the NRCS? And then number two, I see that you appreciate the fact, that the SABS is not longer the one which tests the equipment. What about? I can make an example here. The Auditor General is the one eventually who certifies the books of government, all the departments. But what he does is that he can outsource the work. He can go to PricewaterhouseCoopers, go to that department, check that. Are you going to have a problem when you say that the SABS must be the one which must be the body, and then it can go and look at these private people to do the job, so that they account to them, so that at the end of the day, the standards are sure that the standard is equal national. Are you going to have a problem with that? And then number three will be the issue. How big is your company? How many people are you employing? To what happened? Where is your competition? To what happened as a manufacturer of this equipment? And then what's the problem with the issue of the illegal equipment which is coming to the country? Can you give us, clarify around those issues?
Maybe Honorable Harris?
Thank you, Chair. I have questions around the comments made about provincial versus national competency. I understand the view of as an operator in this country, it would be much simpler if you just had to deal with national. But there are benefits to having provincial regulators and provincial gambling boards, which counter your point. And I'm probably at this point not convinced that there's any need to take those powers away from the provinces. I think it's I'm personally in favour of them having that delegated responsibility. Chair, my question is, however, the implication on the fact that government required a certain BEE rating level, where did that instruction come from? It seems to me that while for your regulation you have to, you're answerable to provinces, somehow in terms of your BEE rating, you're answerable to perhaps the DTI nationally. I want to know, where did that instruction come from? And how is it that you can have those dual lines of accountability? Surely, if you're being regulated from provincial level, something like your BEE grading should come from that level too. Can you clarify that, please?
Those are the three questions.
Thank you very much for the question. In terms of the first one regarding the NRCS, last year in November, the NRCS staff went on strike. They were members of the Niahu Trade Union, and they had certain internal disputes. The result was that for 3 weeks that the NRCS was shut down in terms of letters of certification for the gambling industry, as well as letters of authority for other electrical and electronic equipment suppliers. And then early on this year, they had internal staffing issues, which also caused huge backlog issues with regards to the issuing of letters of certification. Now, to their credit, the National Gambling Board did assist twice, and they also got in touch with the NRCS and had meetings with them to try and sort the problem out, to try and alleviate the backlog that was growing, and to try and get back to a normalized turnaround time for the industry. But my comment with regards to maybe multiple certification bodies to try and prevent a situation in the future where if, for example, that we do have trade union issues or internal disputes at the NRCS or any other body, for example, that the industry does have options to go to carry on, to get that equipment certified, and that it isn't the case of the whole industry coming to a grinding halt as it happened last year and again early on this year. And that's basically the context from which the requirement for multiple certification bodies came from. Then in terms of point question number two, and the SABS being involved in developing norms and standards. Now, to be absolutely honest, I'm not that was a recommendation that the Gambling Review Commission made in their report. What the background to that recommendation was or the actual details to it, I'm not too sure, but I would presume that when the time does come that the SABS does get involved in developing norms and standards for the industry, that all the stakeholders in the industry will be consulted by consultative workshops. So, but that came purely from the Gambling Review Commission report, so it wasn't like an idea for me. Then thirdly, in terms of my company size and our operations and how we impacted on by illegal gambling equipment, we're currently 38 people, and we're currently the largest slot machine manufacturer slash distributor in the country. We have 8 other prominent slot machine manufacturers that also provide maintenance and development services to the casino and the LPM industry, as well as regards to casino monitoring and control systems. In terms of illegal gambling machines, just like everybody else, we are also impacted on when operators, not in South Africa, but like in other parts of Africa, when they purchase machines from people who aren't licensed, that they purchase machines, gray machines, as we like to call them, from overseas at rock bottom prices, and we can't compete at those levels, and that impacts on our business as well. So we certainly do cooperate with all the provincial boards and the National Gambling Board in trying to maintain a streamlined system of reporting any illegal gambling machine movements. So in terms of the next question, in terms of powers being taken away from the provincial gambling boards, what I was actually proposing was a parallel system with a certain type of approvals, just similar with like with national licensing, which exists in parallel with the provincial licensing systems currently in operation, that we have a similar system in place for national approvals of gambling equipment, specific gambling equipment if need be, that are used in all provinces. And in that way, at least for equipment that only certain provinces allow, at least then manufacturers and operators have an option of applying for provincial gambling equipment approval in those cases. But certainly I think it is something that we can look at, that or we should be looked at rather, to try and streamline the business regulation processes in the industry so that we can still achieve the same goals, but it's much easier. Thank you.
This is very short because we want to close Honorable Khadebi on that.
Okay. I would have expected, because there's this new phenomenon of online gambling, to report what impact is it going to have in your operations, or are you adapting to that new phenomenon which is emerging?
Over to yourself.
Sure, thank you very much. With regards to online gambling, we're pretty much taking a wait-and-see approach with regards to how the online gambling legislation and regulations will be shaped in South Africa. Overseas, in certain jurisdictions, the very few rather that online gambling is legalized and allowed or so, our company overseas does provide content for a lot of the online gaming operators, but more like free play content. In other words, it's more like games that you don't pay anything to play, but also you don't get anything from the games. It's just known as free play, wherein it's not a gambling game per se, it's more for, you can call it like a video game, and even there, so you don't pay to play it, and you don't win anything from it. But that's pretty much the extent to which we will be involved, and we, in South Africa, we're just waiting to see how the online gambling legislative landscape is going to be shaped before making our decision. And one more thing, Manager, sorry, I forgot to answer the question about level 2 and where did it come from. That came from the National Gambling Policy Council, which where meetings were held over the last couple of years to discuss the topic of BE in the industry. And the National Gambling Policy Council is made up of representatives from all nine provinces, representation from the National Gambling Board, the Department of Trade and Industry, and from there, the order or the mandate went out to all the provinces that all licensees shall comply with a level 2 compliance level in 2015.
Right. Thank you very much to Aristocrat, Mr. Mumbod. Thank you. Members, I alluded to, I'm not sure of the name here because the committee secretary is not here, who was prevented from getting the information that it was cancelled or postponed, and that is Amar Tweeney Sport. 7 minutes, please. Thank you. It's Mr. Is it Dr. Jan de Wit or is it Mr. Johan Wielman? No, well, can you come on that side, please? Thank you. Right.
Jesus.
Can you just hold on a minute, please? As I indicated earlier on, this Amar Tweeney Sport is here. I was asked by the chair by the committee secretary if we could accommodate them. I said only if we had finished before 15 minutes past. So I'm just reminding members of that. Honourable Smaller?
Chairperson, I'm just asking if the presenters has got any sort of documentation for us to assist us during this.
It is there, I understand. Secondly, I know members have always got the larger, detailed sort of book, if I may put it that way, although we don't always all bring it along. So I'm going to immediately hand over. I've explained the exigency, because you're not on the program now. It's an exigency that has enabled you to be here. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for accommodating us, because of the misunderstanding, we are only here for today from Bloemfontein. But thank you very much, and good morning to everyone and everyone in the audience as well, and all the members. I guess these questions, we are only giving you for the minute. We are going to accommodate you. We are not going to ask those questions and expect answers from you, because we don't want you to get the perception that we are trying to score cheap points. That is not why we are here. Previously, we submitted this promotion from Professor Elizabeth van Deventer from the university, where she did research on the dog racing. You also received a report from Shane Brody. You also received a report from Hassan Collins, the head of the International Greyhound Racing Association. But apart from that, that is submitted previously to this committee. Apart from that, I just want to make a few points. I'm a vet residing in Bloemfontein at Winter Street 19 for the last 30 years. I'm a South African citizen with paying my tax, income tax. I've got a VAT number. and I'm paying my municipal taxes. I'm the owner, also the owner of a greyhound. By the way, that is the fastest greyhound in the country. But you see, I've been discriminated against by two different dispensations, the previous government and this government. I'm not allowed to raise my greyhound. Although we've got a legal opinion from the Professor Elizabeth Sneyman van Deventer from the varsity, she said, and the whole legal department of the Free State Varsity say that under the Constitution we are discriminated against. You see, the previous government discriminated against dog racing on the ground of gambling. It is against the church, against religion. Although at that stage horse racing were allowed. Under the recent government from 1994, dog racing is still illegal. It looks now it will remain illegal according to the report that we received from this committee. And that is based on animal welfare issues that may or may not become reality. You know, in South Africa at this stage, we've got the best constitution in the world. No discrimination is allowed according to race, sex, religion. This conditional court is see, the constitutional court is see that it's implemented. Like examples that happened in the last few months of the last year, voting rights to prisoners, voting rights to South African citizens overseas. This decision of the Constitutional Court is based on common law. Common law is saying that all people must be treated fairly and just as judged by the person on the street. Now, if I am going to ask a person on the street today, do you think it is fairly fair and just that a horse owner can race his horses, that a pigeon owner can race his pigeons, but a dog, greyhound owner, are not able to race his greyhounds? I think the answer is obvious. Okay, to come to welfare issues, you know we are making a big issue about the animal-human relationship. The animal gives unconditional love to the, and is very important for the old person and the teenage, for the teenager, that is to receive. If we are, every one of us has children, we give love to that child, but it is conditional. He must behave himself, he must do good in school, and so forth. But the dog gives unconditional love. Greyhound has the least aggressive against human being of 45 breeds that has been tested. Okay, job creation, the submission of Sean Collins, you've got. Mr. Johan Eman, have you got it? Thank you. Mr. Johan Eman has been to Australia looking into ground racing, and he said it's a big industry there, creating many jobs. Traditionally, hunting with grounds is a of the indigenous people, and we want that dog off the field on the race. due to animal welfare. You see, what we are asking for is just and fair treatment from this committee. Please withdraw the discriminating legislation. At the moment, it is not a legislation even. It is regulations lying with the different provinces. Just withdraw it and sit back and see what happens. Because then you haven't got even us the right to gamble. But then in a few years' time, if you still need jobs, to create jobs at that time, I think we are in South Africa in for a very big growth and economical development. Because the whole Africa is lying open for us. So for Jonas did stand here in Cape Town and he said, I've seen a road from Cape to Cairo. We built a railway, we built electrical lines, we built gas lines, we built hydroelectricity, we developed the whole Africa. Why should we now worry about the dogs? Let us run our dogs. Thank you very much. I think you also want to say something.
Brief comment from yourself, Mr. Humer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. This has been a long road for our company that is trying to get a regulated industry in South Africa. I would just like to shortly say that the fear that currently exists are largely based on perceptions and a lack of knowledge. We would like to be given the opportunity to change this. There are several breeds of greyhounds, some that is founded in South Africa. You get the North African Saluki that is in the from Egyptian times noted. In Eastern Europe you get the Bordeaux that is a long-haired greyhound in snow conditions. Traditional, locally we bred the Burond, that's a specific greyhound that's been exported all over the world. And then when we come in, we are the owners of track racing dogs. That's a specific type of greyhound. You breed for a specific distance, 300 meters, 500 meters, 700 meters. It's athletes, super athletes, that needs to be taken care of well, that we do provide them with the necessary foods and supplements and everything that they need, vitamins. You also get the miniature greyhounds. There's several types of them, the Italian ones. So it's a different, it's a big statement to say greyhound racing, but this, if you look at the actual cruelty against, let's call it greyhounds, let's try and specify which kind of greyhound is being mistreated. South Africa is currently importing and exporting greyhounds. We have established a market in the east and Northern Africa. I myself have imported greyhounds from all over the world, Australia, New Zealand. We have got very competitive bloodlines and racing bred greyhounds in South Africa. You mustn't think you import a dog and you're going to outperform the local dogs. Then just basic stuff. You may race a horse, you may sit on it and eat it. You may race a pigeon, but a greyhound that's a natural racer, not allowed to race. This morning I saw in the news that our president, or my president, Mr. Zuma, said that we must try and stay out of the courts. We are trying to do this the right way. We have come a long way. We are really trying to to get an industry regulated to prevent taxi hunting, that's a big menace in Natal, illegal racing and mistreatment of dogs. There's a few good men. We are them. We would like this committee to make a positive recommendation. And you can change a lot of people's lives in this regard. Please give us a chance. Thank you.
I'm sure the whole committee can hear the passion, I must say. I must say, I was unaware the Free State Honourable Khadebe was in the greyhound racing. But you did not brief us. But notwithstanding that, we do appreciate you coming here. We actually do have other inputs from you, as you know. You've submitted those to us. And as I said to the online or whatever gambling we had the other day on Friday, when we know that that is illegal in the country at the moment, and yet they came through to the committee and we learned it is kind of operating here, I suppose we have to some degree adopted the approach, let's hear what you have to say, at least, and then we can look at the whole matter completely in a broader fashion. So I'd rather, you know, right now I'm coming to the end of this, Mr. Human. So, you know, I see you attempting to hold up that hand, and I really want to see if the committee gives you that space with their questions, and then you can come in on one of the questions, you understand. So, I'll take a maximum of three questions in 2 minutes. Thank you. Honourable McIntosh. Anyone else?
Madam Chair, can I say that I support the discriminatory element, provided it's regulated, obviously, which it would be, and clearly the horses are well regulated.
Honourable McIntosh.
Racing horses, horse racing, yeah.
It's a dog.
I know, but I say provided they are well regulated as the horses are. That's my point, yeah. Madam Chair, you know, Mr. Khadebe says I'm a Zulu boy. He's a Free Stater, but he's a bit of a Zulu boy too. And I can tell you, I'm a cattle farmer on extensive farms in KwaZulu-Natal. I have been the president of the KwaZulu-Natal Agricultural Union. This taxi hunting is a fantastic traditional Zulu activity, but it is illegal. And it results in poaching of game. It's an endless problem. But it is an absolutely authentic, legitimate part of Zulu culture. And I believe it should be recognized. And I think a lot of the illegalities would disappear if it could be channeled or as Baden Powell would say, sublimated into a legal system. So from my perspective, provided it's obviously properly managed, I think we ought to introduce it as soon as is reasonably possible.
I was giving you just into extra 1 minute there, Honourable Harris.
Thanks, Chair. I'm interested in the international situation. How many countries have legalized greyhound racing? And how many forbid it outright? You know, what is the international situation? And then secondly, the Gambling Commission had serious concerns relating to overbreeding. I don't think that's something you tackle there. It's central to their opposition to legalizing greyhound racing. Obviously, it's a concern. How would you mitigate their worry?
Thank you. I'm sure also, just before you take the floor, Doctor, you know, it's taxi, is a taxi hunting or whatever, and I'm sure I'll take out my notes again just to find out, because I'm sure they're not chasing the minibuses. I would hope so. So I'm not going to give you all that time to explain about taxi hunting. If you can assure me that it's in the larger input, If it's not, then you'll give us more written information on exactly what taxi hunting is, because I come from KZN, I never heard of taxi hunting. Right.
Sure, just on the point of information, I'm not colluding with
we are now coming across to yourself, Doctor. To yourself.
Thank you very much. I'm not going to waste the time of this committee any further. Your questions is in this report of Professor Elizabeth van Deventer. Please go to that. It is handled extensively there, and it will take time to answer all those questions. Please go to that report. It is a 200-page report. Please go to that. Everything is there. And then, Johan, do you want to say about taxi?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to say that it's been dealt extensively, all the different spheres, but it's quite interesting. I've got a copy of the actual citizen of highlights in the last 20 years, and in 1983, one of the highlights in the citizen was the ANC promises to legalize ground racing. That was in 1993. I've got the copy here. This is the newspaper. So a promise is a promise. It may take some time. So this is some greyhound newspapers from Australia that just shows the magnitude of the industry. It's massive. You've got to take time to read the stuff. But in any case, that's in short. Thank you.
I think we're going to welcome just a little copy of that. That clearly is part of your your archive. So we don't, if we can just get a copy. I notice you've got a larger book. Maybe useful for us to get that, because I know Honourable Harris was saying now which countries, how many, etc. And that kind of information would be useful. So before you get up, because I do need to just speak to all of those who've made a presentation in this regard. We obviously take any commitment seriously, wherever it's made, but I must say, Mr. Human, he would make a very good politician just then. I noticed that you've got all the makings of one. But may I just add that we have come to the end. I'm under a very, very tight schedule. I want to say to all of those who presented without the response, all of them, there are questions here that have been raised, and which you may not have had the time to flesh out. Please do so in a written response addressed to the chair, which goes by the committee secretary, Mr. Hermans, in the same way you submitted your material. Now, this is going to be a long, long process. We've just realized we need to bring in more online people and so on. Gambling is a serious matter, and we do need to ensure that we are effectively informed in order to legislate thereof. I'm sure that's what you would want yourself. So we know we're near the end of this process. The Honourable Khwabasa is heading a working group in this regard, and he himself has pointed out many of the issues that we need yet to tackle, the challenges. But I do really appreciate you sharing us with that in a very transparent manner, because, yes, it is alarming on the one hand that what is illegal in the country continues, yet at the same time, as I say, I'm glad we have this platform, which in one sense offers you a sense of immunity to share with us this, so that you feel you can come out and share this with us. I'm sure everyone does, whether they're opposed to it or not. So I do hear where you're coming from, believe you me. thank you. Particularly yourselves. Also, earlier on, we had the Funding Practice Alliance and also the Aristocrats, which I thought was only one of those little animated TV shows. But thank you very, very much for the input. We regrettably have to ask you to clear these seats so that the Department of DT, the DTI, headed by the DG, Mr. Lionel October, can just take the floor. Thank you very much. And just to indicate to the committee that we are going to have tea after the briefing by the DG. I hope I'm quite clear now. So we're going to have the briefing by the DG, a short briefing here, Mr. October. So if you could come up here, we do. Do we all have... Members, do we all have this? Honourable Harris. Honourable Harris, we haven't closed the committee. If you wish to discuss anything, please leave the committee. Because I know that there are some urgent issues. Right. Now that we are still in committee, if we can immediately go through to the Honourable Mr. October. And simply to say to members that I appreciate you understanding, those of you who were present yesterday, the exigencies that have arisen in the report and the need to have it clarified so that we can proceed in confidence with the report. And thank you very much, Mr. October. If you just make a short input here and then we'll clarify some of the issues that you may wish to speak to and engage us on afterwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It will be very, I've got about 6 or 7 slides. Thanks for the invitation, albeit at that short notice. I'm going to mainly cover the NCC, the National Consumer Commission, as per your request, and then the other issues one can deal with immediately afterwards, as you indicated. Madam Chair, if I can just firstly deal with the National Consumer Commission, I think that's common knowledge. It only came into effect this year. But the really important point about the National Consumer Commission or new entities is the fourth bullet point. As I said, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, the PFMA, in terms of Section 38.1J, it specifies the relationship between the DTI and its agencies, or any government department and its agencies. And it says, firstly, and I'm going to come back to this, before transferring any funds to an entity within or outside government, must obtain written assurance from the entity that the entity implements effective, efficient, transparent financial management and internal controls systems. That's a requirement on myself as the accounting officer in terms of the PFMA. So in March this year, I wrote a letter to the commissioner, well, both commissioners, but of the NCC, to say that before DTI can transfer any money, they must put the financial systems in place, and they must then confirm to us in writing that they have done so. Also in the letter, which I have a copy, which can be distributed, I also laid out explicitly and in detail what is required or what a efficient financial system. It's a division of responsibilities. You must have a chief financial officer. You must have a computer system. You must have, as I said, lines of authority. The person who issues the money can't be the person who authorizes, and so forth and so forth. As I said, DTI has been managing over the past
well, past many years, 21 agencies we now. So I laid out in detail. And we, in end of July, we received a response from the commissioner to say they are now ready to implement the systems. Our financial team then went in and interrogated and again discovered that there wasn't sufficient systems in place, gave them an extra month to put the systems in place, and that's why for the first period, for the first 6 months of this year, DTI has been paying the bills and managing the finances of the NCC. On the 1st of September, after we got the official confirmation, the next day we transferred money into their account. So I'm just trying to, through this first bullet point, explain in terms of the PFMA why we have a situation where for the first 6 months DTI managed the finances of the NCC. Now they have the systems in place, and as you know, they have a new chief financial officer which started a month or two ago. And then finally, also in terms of how financing works, as you know, we work on cash flow projections with our agencies. The chief financial officer must write to the DTI and say, this is our cash flow projections, we need this money. On that basis, cash is transferred. As you know, government works on a cash flow basis because government lends this money. We pay interest on our debt, so it doesn't mean you can, in a sense, sit with money in your account. You have to do it as on a needs basis. So that's how money works with the NCC. In terms of MTF allocation, this is, as I said, this is what was approved in the MTF, approved by Parliament for 2011-2012. 32 million was allocated to them. It will go up to 41 million next year, and then up to 43 million. As I said, this is the approved budget by this Parliament and by the Appropriations Bill. As our minister indicated, DTI receives requests for about a billion more than we actually get. All our divisions, all our agencies always ask for more than what they get. We can obviously, if there is more money available, we can obviously use more money to incentivize the manufacturing sector. But this is what we got after the process. As I indicated, after the NCC confirmed to us that they had the systems in place, we transferred the 19.792 million to them in September. And again, in addition to the allocation of the 32 million, also Ms. Ntuli in 2009 applied for SWEEP funding. And we were allocated, and they were allocated 16.1 million. This is in addition to the 30 million. That was approved, what was approved for them was 16 million. So I'll come back to that again. So as you can see, 32 plus 16 is about 48 million, which they have at their disposal. This is the budget which was submitted to the DTI from the NCC at the end of September, when they were supposed to now take over their own finances. Now, it's very important to look at this budget. There's two points to make. Is that the NCC itself projects that for this year they will spend 27 million. Which means they will have a surplus of about 5 million, as I indicated. The 31 million, this is just of the MTF, leaving aside SWEEP funding. This is their budget submitted to us. Not the ideal budget which they submitted to yourselves, because you asked them, in the best of worlds, what would you want? And they said they wanted 94 million. But as I said, we never saw that budget, because we never asked them for an ideal budget.
But what we did ask them for their real budget, which they submitted on the 30th of September. So as I said, on their own. What is also clear is that for the first 6 months, we as DTI, we spent 10 million is the actual expenditure to date. And I think this is again important because that is why we were a bit surprised to think that you can move from spending 10 million in your first 6 months, you've got 6 months left, and now maybe 4 months left, how on earth are you going to spend 94 million or 84 million? So, as I said, we've got 10 million which was spent. Again, to repeat, their own projections is that they would spend 27 million in the year. This is just a breakdown of the sweep money again. Currently, as I indicated, in terms of Zodwa's initial proposal 2 years ago when we established this consumer, they made contingency arrangements for this institution. They were allocated 16 million. To date, 6 million has been spent from the sweep fund. So there's 9 million available in the sweep fund. If we take them all together, and just again, as you know, the sweep program, as a reminder, is not a slush fund. It is a on-budget allocation from the European Union. And as I said, for anything that we have in addition to our budget, we at least have some money from the EU which we can use. On, as I said, it's different from the old way of EU funding where they funded projects. Here, they give us the money and we decide where the money goes. And as I said, this is the funds. Again, money is made on the basis of expenditure. So again, there is sometimes this notion that people want to sweep money in their account. And as I said, we can only do it on the basis of expenditure. We can't just put money in people's accounts and then hope they do spend it. So in summary then, the position then for the remaining 6 months, if we take that we spent 10 million in the first quarter, in the first half of the year. So if we then take it then, what is available to in total, if we take the year as a whole, let's say 32 million from the from the MTF, 16 million from sweep, which means that the NCC has 49 million available to itself for the year. Expenditure to date, 10 million. Of the MTF, they have available 22 million left, and also from sweep, 9 million. So there's 31 million left from the initial allocation. This is the current position of their finances. As we indicated then, the status of the submission that we received after they made their submission to yourself, firstly, I mean, the submission of the NCC's budget submission to you is not very coherent. There is items which have been duplicated, we give an example there. Usually, in any case, these kinds of things are never brought to the portfolio committee before it is worked out between the CFOs of our different agencies. But in any event, because of the way this matter evolved, it was submitted to yourselves, but as I said, that means significant reworking, and the two CFOs have been working now, and they do have a system going for finalizing this expenditure. They've clarified these issues, and they've thanked us for that, and as I said, that is working. I won't even go into the second one, but even the rentals and the printing costs wasn't properly costed, and so on. So, as I said, Madam Chair, as you know, we appeared every year
before the special committee, accounts committee, SCOA, where DTI and many agencies are mainly accused of underspending. As you know, our underspending was 6%. For the first time, usually we're under 5, but we were 6%. Again, with the NCC, all we can say is that in the first year, the money that was allocated was, as I said, based on the establishment. In your first year, you establish your, you put in place your systems. Secondly, you then develop a spending pattern. And then, as I said, if on that basis, if you, for example, you find that you don't have sufficient money, then clearly that helps you in motivating for additional funds. But you must at least show you've spent all your money before you're going to get extra money, and that you've spent it properly and well. You didn't engage in fiscal dumping and so on. So that's why we're saying to the NCC, Madam Chair, with due respect, let them go through their first year. They've spent 10 million. They've got still triple that amount available for any further spending. Let them continue. At the end of the year, we can review. As we indicated, if there is additional funding requirement, we still also have the sweep funding available. But we can tell you with experience that it is Treasury will not give you an extra cent if you had underspent in the previous year. Because how does it make sense for you to say, I want additional money when you can't even expend your existing money? And what is clear is that we have 4 months left for the year, and the NCC is going to underspend. There's no way you're going to move from spending 10 million in 6 months unless you engage in serious fiscal dumping. So therefore, we are concerned about that. But, Madam Chair, so this is the presentation. But as I indicate, as the Minister indicated to the NCC, that if ever they run into a problem with money, we will, as I said, we've got a in a sense, not a slush fund, but we've got a stopgap measure for the sweep funding. But as I said, we don't even think they'll reach that that need of the 16 million. So let me say that's the NCC budget, and I hope this clarifies at least some of the matters with regard to the finances of the NCC.
I must say, DG, we do appreciate that. We also appreciate you know, that we have our DDG here with us, both of them, or three of them, or two of them certainly, Ms. Zordway and Thule, that we see regularly in the committee, as you know. But I must make one thing clear on behalf of the committee. We did not ask for the ideal budget at all. There was never a word or phrase used here. We asked for the detailed. That is a far, far cry from the word ideal. And the reason for that was we couldn't make, it was very difficult for us to work out exactly what the issues were, because we didn't have that, and they appeared to be, well, we just couldn't tie it up and align it. And then we got what was called the detailed budget in that regard. And it became apparent very soon that there seemed to be a further lack of alignment, etc., which is why we had to request a response in writing once the DTI and NCC had in fact, you know, met on the matter. And I must say, what we are getting here has been extremely helpful and constructive in this particular regard. We do just on the one issue that I may have misheard, you know, etc., we became aware that the sweep funding, which you explained very well last time and again now, is currently kept in something called in something something fund, an employment whatever fund. And we just want to be sure of that, so that while we all now know what the sweep fund is very clearly, we also wanted to make reference to where it is, you know, located per se. And I think that that has been our approach up to now. So I'm going to DG immediately. I wanted to hold the tea as soon as it came, as members know, so we have a natural break. All right. We do have a natural break, and the reason for that, DG, is so that we finish with the tea in 10 minutes, come back, and then we have a longer stretch and not break it in between. So, members, can we please look at a 10-minute tea break and return? Thank you. Yes. Where we were on the point of moving from international trade and economic development, am I correct there, Mr. Herman? We have a challenge in the committee room, this room, in that we've had a challenging, the system wasn't working when we arrived. They got it to work. I'm sure you're aware of that. They have been requested to return. It has stopped working again. And it seems to be a week of challenges, what with the mace not being even able to be extracted from its holding device yesterday during a most important three-line whip. It was held fast. As Shakespeare would say, all the elements seem to be working against us. Today we can say technology. But I think we do have to press on, and what I'm happy to say is that we can complete this so that the DG is on board as well. While we're waiting for some of the systems to come up, DG, what I thought we would do was to carry on with what we have to raise the issues. Are we all on track? Honourable McIntosh?
Are we dealing with now with Mark 3, with a document that was delivered this morning, not the one yesterday?
Were yesterday hasn't changed, you follow?
Okay.
Yeah, so I must just make that clear. So, you know where we were yesterday on the document? But, I mean, you did leave a little bit earlier, yes.
No, don't pull that one on me, Madam Chair. I did leave earlier, but if you look at Mark 3, you've added in the beginning some stuff that wasn't there in Mark 2. Not that it's wrong, it's not wrong, but there are one or two little bits added. But I just want to make sure that we're dealing with the same document, all of us. Is it this Mark 3 that was delivered this morning?
Well, I'm going to allow the Hermans to speak quickly to that. Because
thanks.
There was a new document distributed this morning, draft 4, but we as a committee, we worked on the document draft 3 yesterday. That was yesterday's document.
That's the one we're working on. We're not going backwards. We've got to go backwards, but right now we're pressing forward. on the, as it were, uncharted territory. So can we just complete that process first, please? Right. The enterprise organization are making sure that we're all on the same document as we proceed. So, from here, we were completing the going towards human resource. What we were doing here, just to remind everyone and refresh everyone's memories, we were looking at some of the key issues that we may wish to comment on as a committee, and then press on. So, page 24, I was reminding members that the information they've got is not new from the BRRR. You know, you've had that document over and over, so what you see here was simply put into another area. You come to the bottom, underspending there is referred to on page 20, which is the bottom of 5.46. Point one. Have you all got that? And it refers to the jobs. That's why I'm there. Underspending, and then we just say commitments. Although the finalization of the automotive investment scheme has catalyzed commitments by the automotive industry to the value of $14 billion, the effective starting date for the AIS was only in the second quarter. Commitments have been allocated in the budget and three claims were paid in March 2011. The AIS is expected conservatively, there's just something wrong with the sentence here. I think the AIS is conservatively estimated to create a minimum. Okay? Are we all on track? No, you see, because of my eyesight, I have slightly larger. So I'm just giving you the numbering. 5.46.1. Then we go on to, because we're just completing yesterday's process, we then came to the issue about we'd finished already the expenditure under capital expenditure, $320,000, just above human resource oversight report for the operation of foreign missions. And that was in reference to the under expenditure, and the explanation was very clear, that this was due to the capital expenditure of $320,000 and a delay in the procurement of the computer equipment. The human resource oversight report, and there we tackled a lot of that under the vacancies. Do you remember those of you who were here yesterday? And we requested that we identify some of that information separately, and we clarified that in terms of the 6 months, and we have been reliably informed that the department takes 3 months on average to fill a position. Is that right, Ms. Schultz? I think you indicated that.
Thanks, Chair. From start to finish, that's the maximum that we've been allowed to operate within.
We then have the Auditor General's report here. In this regard, most of us again are familiar with that. This is not new information. The key issues raised by the committee, 5.4.10, the decline in government investment, an issue was raised under training. And I want, the reason I'm mentioning that, it's one of those that will undergo a shift in location. Please just note that. Please note that, please. It's going to be relocated in the last document. The training expenditure, okay? Incentives. When we discussed this during the BRRR, we said we won't have time to go into all of the incentives, etc. It is best that we invite them at a later point in time to engage with us. Increase in under expenditure. The committee inquired to the reasons for the increase here. The minister expressed his concern in the increase in under expenditure. I think this is an important bullet. We need all members to be focused. Honourable Mabasa.
I didn't come with yesterday's document, Complete Chair, so I'm having today's one. My question is it possible to follow the discussion on using either of the documents? And if it is, then I will ask that you indicate for each document the page. And
thank you very much, Mr. Herman.
It's on page 14, 4.3 is the issue that the chair is raising now in the new page 14, 1.4.
No, but you see, I just think if you're referring to the one handed out this morning, it raises problems.
No, because members have had.
Asked members to bring the old document so that we could complete the work that we had started. That was yesterday. These have not changed because we haven't worked with them per se. The only thing I'm alerting you to is a change in location, that's all, which I've done so already. The estate agency legislation here, the minister informed the committee that the current debate within the government is how the estate agency board relates to the mandate of that. I think that was our statement. We may wish to say, having studied the inputs that we've seen, that basically the issue is they were asked to discuss this between the two departments. So the two ministers are in the process of their discussions on this matter. That's the issue there. The beneficiation was raised by someone. The minister informed the committee that some beneficiation is already taking place without policy intervention. We later referred to the beneficiation, but it would have been useful if we have the time to put in what this beneficiation is that is occurring at this time. And I'm also just alerting Mr. October just to that point about the beneficiation. The importance of the mining sector to the South African economy should not be underestimated. Beneficiation of primary products remains a concern. What programs are in place to ensure that South Africa beneficiate. The committee, that sentence is not reading well. The beneficiation of primary products remains a concern. The committee raised the issue of programs that are in place to ensure beneficiation. The minister informed the committee that some beneficiation is already taking place without policy intervention. It's all very well for us to say this, but we don't indicate anything. Solo heating, that came up yesterday. SABS informed the committee that 95% of the industry is foreign owned. The DTI is not concerned with the ownership. Well, I'm not sure that I even came across that. So that's why I'm raising it. As long as the product is manufactured in South Africa, right, SA should eventually, like China, develop their own local. It wasn't a matter that the DTI and my notes weren't concerned with ownership, but rather that the DTI's primary focus was ensuring productive investment through the establishment of plants. That's what I've got. But members, if you want to make any other comments in that regard, you're welcome to. Right, proceed. I hope that's clear. South African Bureau of Standards. I think at this point, Honourable Khadebe, our whip, will be quite on top of things there, because I missed that input. That is point, so next point six, South African Bureau of Standards. An overview of the South African Bureau of Standards. Support South Africa's industry's competitiveness by developing, promoting, and maintaining these national standards, promote quality in connection with commodity goods and services, and three, provide conformity assessment services and matters related to this. The key issues raised under that, the following issues. By the way, we've done this repeatedly, so I'm only going through the areas that were raised in this regard. One of the areas was with competition. The committee inquired about the role of SABs, given the establishment of similar entities in the private sector. SABs informed the committee that it is the only body mandated to develop national standards, and it is the body working with the International Standards Organization. All other bodies must comply with either national or international standards. Currently, there seems to be a lack of cohesion. And I'm saying, this is the sentence you have to read carefully. Currently, there seems to be a lack of cohesion between government departments and SABs as it works outside the quality assurance offered by SABs, as it works outside, not work, it works outside that, okay, during the procurement process of goods, government departments must be obliged to insist on SAB SABs compliance of all products purchased. And then we have the National Regulator for Compulsory Specs. The key issues, 7.2, testing and approval. I'm sorry, just a minute. Can I just get some water, please? In a cup. I don't drink out of bottles. And possibly on a picnic. Key issues. Testing and approval, staff complement. Committee. Yes, yes. What I'm looking at here, and I just wish to come to it, is serial non-compliers. Are we all, have we all captured that under 7.2? The committee inquired whether the NCRS has established, considered the establishment of a register to name and shame serial offenders of non-compliance. Non-compliance of products, or non-compliant products, you see. I hope the corrections are being made, Mr. Hermans. The NRCS informed the committee that non-compliant products are destroyed or sent back to the country of origin. Legal action is instituted against offenders, with the profits of such illegal activities going to the state. You see, I think it's the way the sentence is worded, like the state, you know, we're running an illegal racket of sorts. I take it we're saying they destroyed or sent back. If they sent back, you haven't yet had the profits. So maybe we can just get some clarification here. Because it says here, the NCR is informed that non-compliant products are destroyed or sent back to the country of origin. Legal action is instituted against the offenders with the profits. The fact is they have, it's been sent back, you see. So with the profits of, the offenders with the profits of such illegal activities going to the state. So the profits go to the state. So what profits do you get if it's been sent back? They're destroyed or sent back. Yes.
I think what they mean is that legal action is instituted, and some of these offenders have already made profits, and therefore I think it should be such illegal profits are forfeited to the state or something like that.
Sentence should be reworded.
Or any illegal profits.
But certainly the state is not getting profits from stuff sent back as such. You know, I think that ought to be quite clear. I mean, I understand from SARS, etc., when you're not allowed to sell things even that are impounded, etc., they are destroyed. I'm not sure what profits are obtained. The NCC. We've just been on this issue. We've had this clarification, if I may put it that way, just the point about the sweep fund DG, Mr. October, that we do know what it is, and then just that proper title of the fund itself. Yeah. You know, we get the, that the sweep fund, which is accessed through the whatever, it's got a name, you see, I know, but that's a small point. I know we'll get it before the meeting closes. The NCC Commission is here. The NCC, the second paragraph, we are now going to be reading this one because this is one of those that failed us. NCC highlighted a number of challenges it faced in implementing its mandate during the committee's oversight visit. Among these challenges, among others, ranged from the capacity to fulfill the location of the NCC consumer protection groups, the NCC website, to the NCC being underfunded. The committee in its oversight report adopted on the 2011, therefore concluded that given the information at hand, well, it's no longer the 21st of September. The oversight report itself. Adequate resources, including core capacities, must accompany planned legislation so that when it is adopted by Parliament, the implementation of strategic objectives is not impeded in any way. Given the objectives of the work of the NCC, the projected allocation was clearly insufficient for the establishment and its capacity to provide effective services. I must just remind members that this oversight visit took place in July 2011. You all recall that first engagement. In the light of these challenges, the committee agreed they would invite the NCC to further engage the committee during the BRRR final process phase to ascertain to what extent the committee could assist the NCC. I think the issue is not in what way the committee can assist the NCC, but rather in the same way we approached SIPCO, where we said, what, you've established yourselves, you've experienced these teething problems, what are the measures, you know, what is the situation now? So I think that that was really our process at that point. Now, I'm saying that because I'm asking the committee to make its comment. I mean, I'm making a statement because I'm saying, I didn't say we said we're going to assist the NCC. Or does some member of the committee feel that that statement is in fact correct? Based on the financial information provided by the NCC at the time, it appeared that the NCC may not be able to fulfill its mandate. We say this again. The commissioner provided an update on the issues, etc. The update focused on the capacity. The progress report on its public awareness, etc. And then finally, the potential impact of budgetary constraints on its service delivery, the website and the location. I will stop at this point because this is where we hit the challenges last time, if you recall. And I will take comments from the committee because these are the, we're closing off on this area before the consideration. The key issues are raised out of this, but I think it's pertinent for us to comment at this stage because we are devoting, at this point, two pages to the NCC. In fact, 2.5 to 3. Is there any comment from the committee? Honourable van der Merwe?
Chair, I think this paragraph, in the light of these challenges, is history. It's a historic thing because they did come to our deliberations in Marx Building. I think because they are in the establishment phase, it's difficult for us to say categorically that it may not be able to fulfill its mandate due to insufficient funds. First of all, we have heard that they have not spent all the funds that they've got, and they are unlikely to spend all the funds that they've got. And second of all, they are in the establishment phase, and I wonder if we shouldn't rather refer to that and say we need to ensure that they are properly resourced into the future. I'm concerned with the report that we got from the DG today, which is different to the report that we got from the commissioner, that in fact they have got 20-something million still waiting to be spent. So I think we should take out that paragraph and substitute it with something else, like she's writing now. The NCC is an establishment phase, and it should be... we should ensure that as it develops, it is sufficiently funded, or something like that. Thank you.
There's a position being put forward there. My concern at this stage was that I'm looking at balancing the issues that we're getting with the SIPCO one as well, which is also newly, relatively newly established, but this, whether we like it or not, in so many ways, is the latest baby and deals with very, very important issues that we agreed it should deal with. So on the one hand, mine is a technical issue, and I must say that at the outset, which says we need to balance how much is being written and, as you know, dedicated, can I put to this, or ring-fence. So what I want to propose to do is, looking at the second paragraph, okay, the committee in its oversight report therefore concluded that we had this, the location of all of this, and we concluded that if you look at this, given the objectives, and I think that this is the issue here, given the objectives of the NCC, the projected allocation was clearly insufficient for this, and then we called them back, you see. So, I mean, we streamline that, so we take out, Honourable Khadebi, I hope you hear what I'm saying. I'm talking the NCC page, point 8. The second paragraph We're not, you know, we're leaving one and two. I'm referring to the third paragraph. The third. The July, the, what, you know, which refers to July 2011. And I'm saying we've just done that. Instead of, therefore concluded, that given the financial information at hand and the objectives of the NCC, the projected allocation was clearly insufficient at that. That is what was concluded in July 2011. Okay, are we all on board here? Yes. That was at that time in July. We then, given the situation, the committee invited the NCC to a further engagement in the BRRR. Okay, that's another thing there. And then, at this point here, because we're now in the process, we haven't completed this process as we finish, we now need to indicate that the commissioner reiterated her position. Didn't change much, in fact. Was the same position. And the committee was given a detailed budget, which later needed to be, you see, we later said there was a lack of alignment between what we'd been given by DTI, if you recall, and what they had given us. The committee requested an engagement between DTI and the NCC. Having received that, what are we concluding? Do you follow? We're all now at the same point. Having received that, we've got this latest information, we have the reports, what are we concluding now in the light of that? I think that's what we want from the committee. Because we've only just got the information now, finally. Honourable Harris?
Yeah, I agree with what you said, but you left something out. We requested the NCC to provide, to answer additional questions by the 27th of October. That information wasn't provided. I think the report needs to reflect that. I think to date we still haven't received answers to those questions. So essentially they gave us a report. We asked additional questions. We haven't had the answers, and now we've had the DTI submission. So there's a big hole in the middle there, and I think the report must reflect that.
I think on our inquiries, they have been engaging with staff on a one-to-one to clarify figures, you follow. And they did have the meeting the engagement with DTI, okay, with the CFO. We then have a report which we requested again yesterday. I did anyway. Please, can we have something in writing? At least to give us something that we can rely on. As we sit here, we don't have a written letter to the chairperson in this regard of the committee. Yes, that is a reality. So those are the facts of the matter. I hope I'm clear. So I'm not ruling you out, Honourable Harris. I'm just trying to put it in its perspective before I take another question, another input. Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, look, I think we need to chastise the NCC as a committee which has oversight responsibilities. I think Honourable Funamerva has made the point that they knew they were establishing themselves, but I really don't think we need to make a meal of it. In a sense, the Director General has in a sense, exercised his authority, and he's pointed out that they covered by Section 38.1J, that he will make cash available if they need it, and if they're really in a jam, and he's not so sure they are in as big a jam as they think they are, then he's got the sweep money, which he could draw on. So we're not going to leave them just, you know, high and dry. We are going to look after them, but then they must also learn to govern themselves properly.
Look, somehow between the two positions, we're going to find the response we want to put in here. Honourable Harris, last point on this one before I take Honourable Khadebe.
Chair, I think the line the committee further requested the NCC and the DTR to engage is great, but we also requested additional information on the budget. I submitted four specific questions, and I've yet to receive an answer to any one of them. And you requested as chair that those must be with us by the 27th of October. So what I'm suggesting is that the report just needs to reflect that we asked for specific additional information with a 24-hour turnaround, and we've still yet to receive it. I think that's just an accurate reflection of what happened.
Certain outstanding questions remain outstanding. We have not had a written response. You are quite right. Quite right, Honourable Harris. And I think the point you've just said is you would like to see the report reflecting that. I hope I'm quite clear on that. Right, Honourable Khadebe, as we conclude here, the matter before we're just putting the explanation in. In our opinion, then, the issue is, are we moving forward on that? They may have adequate, because the one issue I did raise there was just to ensure that they did have that in the legal issues that were raised, that all the issues, the challenges, that should these need to be legally pursued, that there would be sufficient funds to do so. And I just want to put it directly to the DG on that matter, but I think, you know, so that there's no misunderstanding. We've indicated these funds will always be available, a shortfall there or here, but with respect to those matters, I think it was SABC and the cell companies or whatever. Yeah. That should there be, you know, should they need to pursue it, they will be able to. And that is adequate legal funding for legal support will be provided, should that be necessary, you know, within the budget. I think that is the only matter. So that was the only issue that may, as it were, impede some of this work.
Madam Chair, just now, just to answer, I think in terms of that, a comment about the detailed budget, I don't know what Ms. Musala maybe reacted a position, and the committee was given a detailed request for funding. You see, the budget is the MTF. Her budget is 33 million. You can't come with a new budget midterm or anything. You can come for a request. Many people have requests. Many people have things. So it must be a request for funding, Madam Chair, so that we don't, so that other agencies don't think they can come to you for during the year for new budgets or something. It's done once a year. So, and then, as I said, Madam Chair, as I said, what I indicated was if there is any agency that runs into problems and they ask for additional resources, as I said, those things will be entertained. It will be considered based on absolute merit. But one cannot beforehand say you're going to give it. And all we're saying is the NCC, like all the other agencies, must submit a request. It is considered as part of the process. And as I said, at the political level, the minister did indicate, because the NCC and the SIPCO are new institutions, is fully supporting, and we will try to accommodate them, but we can't say beforehand, because then people engage in reckless spending if they know they're just going to get money, no matter whether they exceed their budget or not.
I'm going to close this matter now after Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think when we dealt with this issue of the NCC, the issue of the legal funding was the crux of the matter. I think that with the issue of the legal funding was the crux of the matter. That's why with these projections which are given by the DTI today, I think that as the committee you must welcome them, because they've cleared the air of all the suspicions we had before. Because it was the method that in that detailed budget they provided,
there was 26 million for legal fees. Officials told that budget out of balance and whatever. Cannot have 33 million at the same time have the legal fees of 26 million. So I think that's why we requested that additional information so that they go and rework that. I think with this and the explanation coming from the Director General, I think that the committee must be comfortable that we take it, that the NCC is well off. It can look at after its affairs until the end of the financial year. I think that's what my conclude around.
Thank you very much, Honorable Khadebe. I think that we are just rejigging this. We need to come back to it a little bit later on the matter. But simply this, that when we requested the NCC to engage on this, we had already had submitted to us a detailed budget. I think we need to refresh what happened that day on Wednesday. And we didn't write the term budget on it ourselves. It's what they came with. So I think we need to make that quite clear. We're not here assuming that each entity will come with their own budgets. They will prepare budgets which they submit through to the accounting officer, as it were, of a respective organization in government. And then that is what is negotiated, as it were, beyond that. We do know that. But as it is, we do need to just ensure that everything here is correct. But also we need to look at, I'm going to insist, committee members, that once I have worked, I can't just delay and delay. I need, when we have over lunch, I'm going to call for this. This report is X number of pages. And yet, we then devote 10% to the one thing. You can't, you know, we can't do this. It'll be imbalanced because the priority is Y. So we need to, we've tackled the main, the key issues. We need to skip them out, as it were, a couple of lines, and then to ensure that we actually do balanced justice to all of those who came. CIPCO is equally important in a number of ways. So we just need to ensure that we do that kind of thing. So I'm going to ask the committee, in the light of what we've heard here, just to agree on possibly one other issue. I think in the... possibly we can consider, members of the committee, the state, Honourable Harris, consider a comment indicating the importance of receiving these responses on time so that we can deal with them, etc. They may well come and come later. And for that matter, I think members should be aware of, throughout our 2009 and to now, we have come through the steel industry and various others who never provided information on time. But what we did say when we came there was that all, you know, entities need, or whoever comes here when they are requested by a parliament or a committee that serves here, that they need to provide this information. They can't just ignore the requests that are made by the committee itself, because that's important. So allow me to make one clarification with the staff here. Little aside, you will recall as we were coming to the end and we just had names, etc., of these when the reports weren't concluded, we asked about CIPCO. Where is this coming from, you know? It is now being incorporated into the new document. So I do just want to conclude on this document so that we are all in one, as it were, before coming to the rest. And then to move over, that's where we left matters on Tuesday, okay? And that's where we should have concluded. before coming to this document, and for the first time, you will also now see SIPCO included as requested. So I'm going to start off the new document, which is coming towards the final, and that is called Draft 4, and I'm going to refer you to page 11 to just conclude on that aspect. I know you have it, but I can't read that size font. So I need a font that I can read. Thank you. Sorry about that. Fine. I now have a font I can read. My apologies for keeping you waiting. It doesn't change. It's just a higher thing. Right. So on SIPCO, page 11. Your page 11. Now, this is new for everyone. It was what we requested there. CIPC SICA was established on the 1st of May and incorporated into that. During the committee's oversight visit there, again, the same pattern follows. July, okay. Several teething problems were identified. These included new and inherited backlogs, etc., all the issues we raised there, and the billing system, aging, current electronic legacy system to ensure the integrity of data, poor accessibility, etc., and poor call answer rate, and so on. In a follow-up meeting on the 13th of September, the Commissioner, Ms. Astrid Newton, informed the committee of progress that had been made by the end of August and at the number of mechanisms that were being implemented to address the remaining challenges. The following progress had been made. Registrations are closed. We all have this information, and it's recently in our, you know, we've just received it. It's fresh. Only 65 outstanding, 61 closed corporations and 4 co-ops. Only 308 of 64,408 name reservations were still outstanding. Company and closed corporation changes were 98% and 97.7% complete. All the emails and the general email address were cleared, and over 80% of the backlogged emails and the annual returns emails were cleared. The answered calls at the call center increased from the 28% in May to 46% in August. The areas that still require attention are improving data capturing accuracy, annual return payment reconciliation, further improvement in the call center performance and the IT systems, including the website. It's reported that the call center would be outsourced in future and that there was more fundamental work to be done on strategy, etc. The committee indicated that it would continue to regularly monitor the SIPCO to ensure that the CIPC is well functioning. Furthermore, it was concerned about the CIPC's ability to maintain the integrity of the system. Now, I'd like the committee's comment. We put in our comments extensively on NCC. Are we happy with where we are? Unhappy? What are the issues here as we make the committee comment? Yes, Honourable Smala.
Okay, I recall that the commissioner committed herself and department that they will have that within 18 months that they would finalize all their teething problems and they will be up and running within 18 months. And I don't know if we should maybe hold them accountable to that, because when it comes back to the reporting system later on, if some of these issues hasn't been dealt with or completed, then, I mean, there was a commitment from herself, or 18 months from June, if I recall that on her oversight.
Ask the staff to check. I don't recall that specifically, and it doesn't mean to say she didn't say that or she did. I'm just saying I'm going to ask for that just to be checked, please. All right? Point taken. Do we have any other comments before I comment? Anything else committee members want to say at this point before we go to the DDG? Yes, DDG.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to clarify that in the presentation, CPIC did indicate that they have an 18-month turnaround plan, and which they presented to this committee, so I think it can be recorded. I just wanted to clarify that.
Useful for on-the-spot clarification, which we have now got. Thank you very much. Are we happy with that? I think the point, Honourable Harris, is that your hand or?
I think we should add the, there were two other commitments. The one was they were both for the date of December this year. The one was to implement service level agreements. The other one was to outsource the call center. Both of those were targeted at December this year, and I think the report should reflect that.
As I say, it's useful to get that. I would have to confirm that. You know, that's what I'm saying. It's not something, and so we can check and see whether or not the DDG and Thule can confirm that or not. Doesn't mean to say it wasn't said. I mean, it's easy enough to check in our report.
I can confirm that it's part of the 18-month turnaround plan. So what the honourable member is saying is exactly part of that, is inclusive of that. So, but it is correct that they did make those commitments.
It's included in what is called now the turnaround, 18-month turnaround plan. So are you still on that point?
Yes, I've accepted it's included in the turnaround plan, but she did provide specific deadlines of December this year for those two items, so I think that should be specified, as it's being specified.
The overhead, which I'm not looking at, it's probably being captured there. Yeah. Oh, there we are. My word. Thank you very much. What one wanted to say in this regard, and maybe we need to just capture this in the conclusion, is the issue is that there were, in this period, we were looking at two entities, you know, in particular, the CRPC and the NCC as new things that happened. The one established, etc., the purpose for the one, the purpose of the other, and I think that we ought to at least recall what the issues are, because in the achievement of pursuing a balanced report, etc., perhaps I think it is pertinent to indicate that, while we will regular monitoring and all of that, nevertheless, the committee did indicate that it, really, I think our exact words were that we were impressed that they had been able to address things in such a short time. Some of those that were really critical in July and able to make implement some of the measures. So that is the importance there. I think as we do the NCC, we also need then to just indicate the purpose and value of the NCC and the need for that to succeed, as it does affect the majority of the population in this particular regard. So I think these are points that we should try and capture as we get towards the conclusion in that. Now, I just want to be alerted. Was that the last of the so-called new things that were added before we are able to turn back to the beginning of the report? Right. We now move to... We're still on draft four. And as a chairperson, I made some changes to this document. And those changes to the document, after discussions, and I must just preface what I'm going to say, after discussions concerning this format with the appropriations chair in this regard, and also reminding myself that I had been a member of the Joint Budget Committee at the time that this process was conducted of the legislation. For a five-year period, we labored on this and then proceeded to make, to put the legislation forward. It's quite clear to me that there are three things that we said were critical. One, the Budget Office of Parliament, which, as we know, is not yet established. We just don't have the capacity within committees right now to pursue things as we would want to pursue, and as I think we may be required to pursue. The second thing is that the process that is spelled out in that little book, which I made inquiries about as to why some of us have not received it, in particular a number of chairpersons, let alone anyone else. It's because it was not a compulsory set, but rather a set of guidelines that were there that had been superseded by other meetings. So I just want to remind people about these issues, which they may not have had. Nevertheless, we have formatted it more or less than that way, although not required to, it turns out. It's not compulsory. What is required is that we are here to, during the year of that this takes place, to monitor and track this and exercise our oversight through the various processes, be that the MTBPS, which for the next process has just begun, the budget, the various oversight visits, and of course the annual report itself. And to take all that into account, including the quarterly reports, etc., and 32s and so on, and put it all together as a portfolio committee to be able to identify in terms of the policies that the department has come to us with, of which we are expected to exercise oversight. The policies which have been underpinned further by SONA and with the country's overall policy, and what is that? And how does DTI contribute to implementing that policy? With respect to the budget that it receives and the allocations that it has received, how effectively with that allocation has it been able to deliver on its identified targets that were in the strategy plan, the strategic plan? So we had come to the end of the road when we thought we'd have 4 days of this process. We wound up having 2 days. And so we're still under pressure. And I must add that. Extreme pressure. The report, my criticism of our report on a technical basis is that I doubt anyone's going to read it because it's too long. Only those who want to go blow by blow like national treasuring will be going into it, and the national and the trade and industry to see where we have. And so what we have here is an unwieldy document that does not mean to say that there are things that are wrong here, and I must say that. We're saying it's highly descriptive. Instead of coming to the party and having the time to engage each thing as a committee and putting our points down. That's a reality. So next year I want to ask the committee and myself, can we please, as part of this committee, can we please endeavour to improve on how we have done this? Because we are a long way from achieving what we want to achieve in the report that is required. And I think I ought to say that at the outset. In some small way to achieve this, I requested the staff to meet with me this morning at 8, which they did. And the only thing we can do at this late stage is to make it into three parts, as it were. Part one, you see. Part two, this huge detail, and part three, which will be the conclusions and recommendations. And it is part three where you have still to add. Part one, as chairperson, I've exercised that role, which you can still now comment on. And that is to add, in the line of what I have been saying, to try and get us going forward. So I point you now to page one. It's dated the 2nd of November. Has everyone got that? I'm also looking at the department as well. Fine. And here, I'm not going to read the first introduction is what we have already gone through. The second paragraph. Budgeting is driven by the policy commitment to it should be inclusive economic growth. You can later make your comments. It should have been inclusive economic growth and sustainable social development. This is informed by the national policy priorities. The BRRR is a move towards increased parliamentary participation in the budgetary process. This gives effect to the constitutional powers to amend the budget in line with the fiscal framework. I'm stopping there after each paragraph now because I think this is important. If I see an objection, I'll take your hat. We're not, of course, adopting at this point. It's just the deliberations. The DTI's key priorities are to create an environment for industrial development, international trade, and investment to create sustainable jobs through IPAC 2. The IPAC 2 and trade policy work together towards increasing the coherence of micro and macro economic policies. I just wanted to pause there for my own sake as well, because I wondered if we shouldn't have written this a little differently. Honourable Mabasa?
I'm looking at the way we have used the create. It looks like we have got to change the part that has the second create because of the first create that we have on the first line.
We could say contribute to an environment or develop an enabling environment. I'm not putting it to the committee because this was crafted very quickly. What would it be like if we said develop an enabling environment for industrial development that drives strategic international trade, because the whole thing is that trade has changed. So priorities to develop an enabling environment for industrial development that drives strategic international trade and regional trade. It's not just, we need to ensure that it's also a regional process and investment so as to create sustainable jobs. Now, all right, we can clean up the English later. All right. The IPEP 2 and trade policy work towards increasing. I want to make it quite clear, it is the IPEP 2 that is driving the trade throughout here. And we cannot lose sight of it, because previously we did have a slight anomaly that trade drove industry and manufacturing, and we did do that change. So perhaps we could just tighten that a little, but can I come to the end of micro and macro and continue with microeconomic policies consider improving economic efficiency and equity for individual businesses and individuals through the judicial... What? Now, I can read that, but, it is... I know what I wanted to say last night, and I seem to capture it a little differently at 8. Sorry. Yes, DG.
And Madam Chair, I know you made the point about very few people reading it, so they say there's more drafters than readers for these documents, but let me, just a small point about the drafting. I think maybe around that point, because it refers to judicial and regulatory mechanisms, which are not the main tools for microeconomic efficiency. So maybe one should say microeconomic policies consider improving economic efficiency and equity for individual businesses, full stop, because that's what microeconomics is about. It's at the individual firm level. And then, as I said, the other point deals with macro, but maybe just take out that issue about judicial, because I don't think you're going to take somebody to court if they're inefficient, so you're going to, they go out of business.
Well, what if they do? Perhaps in some countries they may well be doing that. But I didn't add the judicial personally and regulatory, so maybe in passing I mentioned that over the coffee. But sorry, I don't think Ms. Herling was under a lot of pressure in my office, so I don't want to start now detracting from her hard work. But what I did want to say about the policies on here is that the SMMEs, that those issues for us are, and I'm asking all the committee members, we may later feel that, and you should comment on, are SMMEs not part of, have we not done well in these areas or not? I'm looking at you, Honourable Harris, because you've never heard this, the statement coming out of my mouth to say right during this process. And, but that was my intention, to try and indicate that we, the idea of the micro was that we were going to try and generate and really boost that. Do you follow where I was, my line of thought at the very least? Thank you.
I think you're entirely correct. My concern is that, by and large, the small business functions have been given to economic development. I mean, we can still express concern, but while we don't have any oversight directly over Kula, our hands are tied.
Well, I'm hoping and I believe that the other committee, our sister committee, who have members sitting on this particular committee, are working very hard in that area, having a leg in both trade and industry and EDD. But perhaps if it's not part of our area, I think the DG will just shout. But I thought we did deal with some of the small businesses, etc. But I may be wrong. That's why I stand to correction. Can we then move to... yes, Honourable Salah.
Okay, why don't we become silent with that whole sentence? Because you can't say policies are considering. The policy is not meant to consider. No, maybe we should do away with that. Just be silent on that matter.
Maybe the thing is, we do need to say micro economic policies contribute to economic. If the intention is to improve the economy there, the small businesses, up to now we've had a focus on macro for about 10, 15 years. That's the point I wanted to make, Honourable Salah. If there was some way we could just make the point that things did change. We're now working more on the micro. That's the point I really want to make. With, as you say, not getting gutted in this manner. Okay. So can we just reserve that a bit? The IP is dependent on a macroeconomic environment, interest rates, and the exchange rate. As I say, it is the IPEP 2 and trade, you know, the combination together that we are industrial. I don't think we have, do we need to say IPEP 2 in the broadest way, or can't we just say industrialization? I don't know. In terms of international trade and regional integration, South Africa has embarked upon improving South-South relations and deepening integration in Africa. This has been and deepening regional integration, I don't know. This has been evident by South Africa joining BRICS, etc., and the developments around the tripartite free trade agreement. However, the pursuit of South-South relations should not be. I think the way I had hoped that this would be worded is that, however, South Africa retains its links with its traditional trading partners, the European Union, which I think remains one of the significant trading partners. So rather than talk about expense, which we can later on, my idea was to say, however, the South Africa retains strong links with its traditional trading partners, in particular the European Union. The department is responsible for 15 entities. You have had this before, we just dragged it from the other paragraph, and 51 acts. These include the two newly established entities, COVID and NCC. The DTI's total allocated budget, and I think there again that's a repetition of what we've had before. That's not new. Now, on the basis of what we've got, purely the principle, Honourable Members, can we agree to go forward on page one on the principle, notwithstanding that we have challenges with some of the wording thereof? Fine. Because the rest is not new. Do you follow? The rest we don't have to read word for word. But I do want to alert you, if you do need to raise issues, you need to flag these issues now. The role of the committee, there's nothing new. The issue I have is this role seems to have rolled out into a huge pancake. 1.2 now. The department, and then we come to page 3. The structure of the report. The report consists of 3 parts. Part 1 introduces, and what I wrote there, introduces the committee's report on the budget review and recommendation report, including that. Okay. Including Yeah, but I don't think we have to say the roles yet again. Full stop. Part two provides a detailed description and analysis of the department's expenditure and service delivery during the previous financial and current. I think what we should have said there provides a detailed description and analysis, yes, of the expenditure. And it's the implementation of policy priorities against identified targeted actions. Those are targeted already. That's what we're trying to measure. And then we can leave the service delivery, because that is service delivery, during the previous, current, previous and current, as well as the oversight of the four entities identified in Part 3. Identified. Part 3 includes the committee's conclusions and recommendations. That's the newness. Now, we've been through this on a blow-by-blow account. I'm now going to ask Mr. Hermans to direct us to anything new. Because we've been through this, those of you who were present yesterday. There's no need now to go blow-by-blow except to be directed to where the new issues may be. What Mr. Hermans will do is do the alert, then I will speak. I think that's the best. Because it's a bit difficult and I don't want to overlook anything. I do know that on the NIPS here, we did have to clarify something, if you recall. Yeah, that's on page 5. Honourable Smuller?
Chair, I think you partly covered me right at the end. I just would like to understand that there were certain changes that came out about yesterday, and if they should not be covered today, you will just tell us how we will address those issues.
Thank you very much. That's what I'm asking for now, not to go as we did yesterday, line by line. Mr. Hermans, we'll have... we want to do this rather quickly, so the alternative is to maybe quick, I'm just trying to look at a process whereby we could get the conclusions on board rather quickly, you know, some good sound advice here from the table, and the recommendations, and then come back to this process. So can we go to conclusions? Now, on the conclusions, Honourable Smuller, you were requesting two yesterday. Do you recall that? You flagged a couple of conclusions, things you would like to be considered for the conclusion. Honourable Harris, you made the statement you weren't sure in what you handed and what we may later decide was conclusions or recommendations. Am I correct there? Is that yes?
Yeah, I did make that statement. I'm happy with the way it's been divided, and actually it was submitted on behalf of the DA, so it was a DA proposal rather than my personal one.
I suppose we realise you are speaking as the leader in the committee of that, the DA. So then we need to look at other conclusions we may wish to come to with all members participating at this point. We can later rejig them across to recommendations if we feel so inclined. I want to make one suggestion to members or proposals, that if we look at the critical issue of the policy priorities and the implementation thereof, we would want to see somewhere along the line this issue of IPAP, industrialization. I know that there are some things that we differ on, but almost all members of this committee do not differ on the agreement or on the objective that we need industrialization. I think the differences may be in how this is done and so on. And that this is a priority and that we consider it through the instrument of manufacturing to be a generator of jobs. You know, I'm just sort of putting it as a little one point. Do we have any comment on that to perhaps go forward as a recommendation here? Followed by Honourable Khadebe.
Chair, it is my view that conclusions should be general and not specific, and that the recommendations should include the specific. I think that when we talk about conclusions, it would be my understanding that it would be a general thing along the lines of what you're saying now about industrial policy or IPAP. I think we should have a general catch-all phrase or a sentence or two that says, basically that we've looked at the strategic plan, we believe it's basically in line with the priorities. There are areas of work that can be strengthened. Those will be contained in our recommendations, that we still consider the IPAP to be the central policy driver. My colleague is better at English than I am, policy driver of the report, but that we have generally found positive results in the Auditor General's report and all the kind of things. I don't think we should be talking about the CPIPC or in the conclusion. It's my view that that kind of remark or that kind of a thing should be rather put forward in the recommendation, because it is a recommendation that we say we have resolved to continue monitoring the thing and so on. So I think we need to generalize more the conclusion and specify more in the recommendation.
I think you've given us a very sound way forward, Honourable Van der Merwe, Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Although she has taken wind out of my sails, it's fine. But the really general conclusion which I was going to come with, we have really to observe and conclude that generally the DTI and its entities are still running their finances properly, as evidenced by the reports of the Auditor General. I think that one must go through as the first one, because we're dealing with the annual report here and the CRR.
One, I'm just looking quickly at what I have as the others or possible others here. I bet that one didn't have any. I'm just asking just for one moment here. Sorry, let me turn. Now, there are points being made here, or rather that were made, which I expect are on here already, from Honourable Harris, who, from what I understand here, is putting this is happy that it was under conclusions that the staff allocate, or rather located it there, that's what I'm saying. Honourable Harris?
Yeah, it made sense to me, but Honourable Sanamava's argument has convinced me for once. So I think actually the implication of what she said is correct, and it means the implication is that my proposals under conclusions need to shift to recommendations.
You want us to consider them under recommendations, rather. So we come with this general conclusion, we've gone through the report, etc. We've come out with this, we note the different things, and it's running, you know, I haven't got the exact wording here, how did we put it? Generally, it has been found that the DTI and its entities are running their finances soundly, as evidenced by the Auditor General's reports. The committee has considered the department's strategic plan and annual report. The fact of the matter is we considered a lot of other the quarterlies as well, which it requires. I would say among the other essential reports that are required, it has found that in general the strategic plan, I don't want to use the word general all the time, so maybe, or have we not used that before, we may want to put the word broadly. The strategic plan is in line, not only with the national priorities, but also with, of course, the department's own policy priorities there, which it has to come out with, the objectives. So those are within, of course, the national priorities. I can put them there. The committee recognizes the importance. We've got to that point, and then Honourable Harris intervened just at that point. And you were saying you would now prefer what you are saying to be considered under recommendations. Am I not? That's where we had just been. So, you're not looking at conclusions yet beyond strategic priorities. Honourable Smaller.
Chairperson, maybe we'll link up to your third paragraph there, but I think the committee should also note that the department has actually gotten two new entities that has been established. Although we talk about the CIPC, but also the NCC, the National Consumer Commissioner. Look, although that they just started now recently, but it's in this annual report for the first time, and I think maybe some relevance to how we see them, or the monitoring thereof, or something in that regard, so that we do take note.
There, when you raise that issue, for some reason it jogged my memory to the IP, the intellectual property, and I did raise this the other day with a colleague to say, have we covered this? We're mentioning all the other new things, the new Companies Act, the new this, the new that. Where do we mention the intellectual property here specifically? Because we've all, and I'm just mentioning that, not now in conclusion, but that it should have been captured somewhere in the report. Honourable Salah?
Jefferson, is it not that this act was passed in this year, which is the year 2011-2012. And therefore, for us to put it in that report would be premature.
I'm not suggesting that it was passed in this period, but the work done in this period was in that period. We did a lot of work on the IP. It had funds allocated to it for that process. But I'm assured that it is here. Sorry. So, no, that was the query I had was, is it here? Because we did have funds. It's under regulation. All right. So we can move.
Your permission, sir?
Yes.
I think we are just passing too quickly on that particular matter on the newly established entities. Okay. No, I thought it was replacing that one that is on the board.
I'm just listening at the moment, and I heard what Honourable Smaller said, and it just reminded me about something. Having now been reassured by the committee secretary, I can move back to the point that was made. Now, the point being made by, I thought though, and this is what I'm just trying, on the one hand, and I'm just trying to caution myself. We take a position, then we move back again. We had a position in which we had a, Honourable Van der Merwe put something forward. Honourable Harris then requested that these recommendations he's made rather be considered under, the conclusion go to recommendations. And then we had something new on NCC and CRPC. Now, either we go with the earlier position and generalise, or we go and we put other issues in. That's what's on the table. No, I'm not talking to yourself, Honourable Silas, specifically, but just to the committee. And, we just need to get clear and then move on. Yes, Honourable Khadir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll prefer that we remove that aspect of the LCC and the CICT in the conclusion part and come with a strong recommendation on the other side, because there are new kids on the block. There are certain things which must still be done. I think that it must be better to go there, because if you go to the body of the report itself, I think it's adequately covered. Whatever. I don't think that you can conclude that there are new the NCC and that cannot come to the conclusion. Let's go to the recommendations. I think because part of the challenges which are there can be, we can only deal with them when we recommend what must be done.
For the moment, not having gone to the consideration, but we are saying we are satisfied. Right, we move on to recommendations. The recommendations that we have, which we now are looking at, one made a recommendation as chair with respect to the IPAP, the industrialization, industrial policy, etc. I did try to get that put on the table here, and then I was opening it up to the House for comment. We are getting there. It's just a matter of the IT. No. Okay. Right, let's just allow Ms. Herning to fiddle around and then look at the screen as soon as she's completed that. Yes, Honourable Vandermeer.
Chair, once again, I think we are dealing with a budget review recommendation report. I don't think in the recommendations we should be saying things like the DTI must submit a report on the establishment of the CI, the tribunal, and so on. I think we've done that in our other engagements with them. We've asked for reports. That will be part of our committee work. What I think we have to do is the broad areas where we think that the money should be better spent. I was looking at Mr. Harris's points that he's made here. Now, for example, 14.7 in this document is submit a report on the vacancy rate in the department as well as plans and time runs. We've got a vacancy rate in the department, And we've heard that it's a 3-month turnaround, if I'm not mistaken, Ms. Scott. So I don't think that should fall. This is a big report. This is about budget review, and we mustn't lose sight of that. We're supposed to give recommendations about how we think the money is being spent. That is what we're supposed to be doing. I think our recommendations should focus on those areas where we really thought that the money was either being underspent, not enough money was allocated, or that there was too much in that area that was being spent. I think we have to remember always that this is a BRRRR report, and it's not just the weekly committee requests for reports or whatever. But having said that, I must confess that I haven't got a draft of my own ideas about such recommendations. But I do think that we must think more strategically about how we frame our recommendations. Thanks.
No, this is why, Honourable Harris.
Yeah, I think Honourable Fenimore is correct, but I think if you look at the list of recommendations and actually the conclusions are now included, they do actually serve that purpose. They weren't sucked out of thin air. The DA went through the draft report and pulled out all of the implications that are contained in that report that require action by the DTI. And they are, I mean, maybe we should debate whether some of them actually have financial implications or not, but the way we've designed them, or put them forward, is that they are all tackling items that speak to budget allocation. So you'll see several of them refer to return on investment, which the spirit of that is, we're spending a certain amount on this item. Are we getting the adequate return from it? I'm happy to go through them one by one, but the committee must hear that we generated them going through the actual reports that's in front of us today, and every single one of them has significant budget implications. I mean, I don't think I've gone as far as to say we're not spending enough here or we're spending too much there, but rather tackling the large items in the department that have budgetary implications.
Now, I hear what both of you have contributed and stated in the committee. But I think this is why I said, what is conclusion, what are recommendations? That was the first thing. The second thing, we are here in this report in the final analysis, while not specifically requesting X amount of money, you know, per se, and taking it away from another sort of entity. What we are expected to try and do is to identify the line item, if you like, the entity that may require more financial, you know, perhaps review in the following budget of more financial aid, whatever. We may be asking for that in this. But I don't think, you see, the one that I actually just highlighted here, because I feel very strongly about the Automotive Investment Development Centre. I think of all sectors, the automotive sector, you know, etc., has done extremely well. And personally, you know, I think the funds they have received, they've utilised, and the private sector have come back to back on the thing. But the fact that payments are not paid autonomously, that is not a request for money or it is not serving that purpose. That's why I say, you know, you need to